From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
We have two systems going on here. One for ordinary Americans. The government takes the money out of your check. It knows what you make. You can't cheat. And another for very wealthy people who are connected who don't want to pay taxes.
Who pays taxes and who doesn't? We'll speak with David K. Johnson. 12 Palestinians were killed overnight in the largest Israeli offensive in Gaza since the 1967 war. Israel's destruction of over 100 homes have left thousands of Palestinians homeless in what's being described as a war crime. We'll go to Rafah to get a report from Israeli journalist Amira Haas. Speak with veteran Palestinian activist Haider Abdel Shafi, among others. And in Miami, a trial has just begun involving the Justice Department and Greenpeace that could have wide-ranging impact on the future of protest in this country. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 12 Palestinians have died overnight in what may be the largest Israeli offensive in Gaza in years. Thousands of Palestinians fled Rafah Monday before Israel sealed off the city, cutting it off from the rest of Gaza. Israeli gunships bombed targets in the city of 90,000 overnight, including the Tel Sultan Mosque. Palestinian sources have told the Associated Press Israeli snipers also shot at two ambulances. Last week, Israel demolished over 100 homes in Rafah, leaving 1,000 Palestinians homeless. The army threatened to demolish hundreds of more homes. Amnesty International called on Israel today to immediately stop the home demolitions, which have left tens of thousands of Palestinians homeless over the past 3 years. Israel claims the attack in Rafah is justified and needed to secure the Gaza-Egyptian border, where they say weapons are being smuggled through underground tunnels. Last week, 5 Israeli soldiers were killed in Rafah, a day after 6 were killed in Gaza City. In Iraq, a funeral was held earlier today at the U.S. occupation headquarters for Izzeddine Salim, the leader of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council, who was assassinated Monday in a car bombing. The head of the U.S. occupation, Paul Bremer, gave the eulogy saying, quote, "We must continue the political process leading to an interim government next month and elections next year." Izzeddine Salim gave his life for this cause, Bremer said, and we honor his life and memory by continuing that quest. Agence France-Presse describes the killing of Salim to be, quote, "the biggest blow yet to U.S. plans for a smooth transition of power." In Britain, former Foreign Minister Robin Cook called on Prime Minister Tony Blair to draw up plans to withdraw British troops from Iraq, but Blair ruled out a quick exit and said Britain would not cut and run. Meanwhile, at least 50 Iraqis, 3 Americans, and an Italian were killed in fighting on Monday. In southern Iraq, Italy suffered its first combat loss, and coalition warplanes bombed portions of Nasiriyah. New York Times is reporting the government has decided to stop its monthly payments of $335,000 to the Iraqi National Congress. The Iraqi exile group headed by Ahmed Chalabi has come under increasing criticism for supplying the U.S. government and media with fabricated or misleading intelligence in the lead-up to the invasion. Since the summer of 2002, the Defense Intelligence Agency paid the group $4 million a year to gather intelligence about Iraq, even though the INC was widely distrusted by both the State Department and the CIA. On Sunday, Secretary of State Colin Powell alluded to the bad intelligence when he appeared on Meet the Press with Tim Russert. Russert asked Powell if he was concerned that some of the intelligence he cited before the United Nations about Iraq having biological and chemical weapons turned out to be inaccurate. Powell didn't mention the INC by name, but admitted the sourcing of the intelligence was, quote, "inaccurate and wrong, and in some cases deliberately misleading." Powell added, quote, "and for that, I'm disappointed and I regret it." This marked the first time Powell charged that anyone had deliberately misled him or the government about Iraq's weapons capacity. On Meet the Press, Russert almost never had a chance to ask Powell about the faulty Iraqi intelligence. Moments before Russert asked what turned out to be his final question, an aide of Powell, who was at a remote location, abruptly pulled the camera away from the secretary in an attempt to cut the interview short. Even though NBC recorded the interview hours before it was aired, the interview was broadcast unedited. One moment, viewers saw Powell speaking in Jordan at a resort on the Dead Sea. The next moment, all one could see was the Dead Sea. After the interview concluded, Russert told the New York Times, quote, "I've been doing this program for 13 years and nothing like that has ever happened. I remember sometimes in countries around the world this happens, but not in America." The State Department says it tried to pull the plug not because of Russert's questioning, but because the interview went on too long. A top U.S. military official in Iraq told the press Monday an artillery shell that may have contained the nerve agent sarin exploded near a U.S. military convoy in Baghdad recently. Former U.N. weapons inspector Hans Blix said the shell was likely a stray weapon, possibly from the Gulf War, and is not likely a sign that Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons before the U.S. invasion. Newsweek is reporting President Bush's top lawyer warned 2 years ago that Bush could be prosecuted for war crimes as a result of how his administration's fighting the war on terror. In 1996, Congress passed a law known as the War Crimes Act that bans any American from committing war crimes or grave breaches of the Geneva Convention. To protect the president from such prosecution, his attorney, Alberto Gonzalez, urged in a January 2002 memo that the administration declare the war in Afghanistan to be exempt from provisions of the Geneva Conventions. Gonzalez wrote that it, quote, "substantially reduces the threat of domestic criminal prosecution under the War Crimes Act." More connections between the Bush family and Saudi Arabia have emerged in the Riggs Bank scandal. Last week, federal regulators fined Riggs Bank a record $25 million for willful systemic violations of anti-money laundering laws, in part due to the bank's failure to monitor tens of millions of dollars in cash withdrawals from the Saudi Arabian embassy. Riggs Bank is headed by a longtime friend of President Bush's, Joe Alberton. The president's uncle, Jonathan Bush, works as the CEO of the investment arm of Riggs Bank. In New York, the 9/11 Commission begins 2 days of hearings today examining why the city of New York was not better prepared for the September 11th attacks, especially in coordinating the rescue effort between the police and fire departments. The panel's chair, Thomas Kane, said, quote, "We'll be asking questions that haven't been asked before, at least not publicly. I think the shock was so great for all of us who lived in the region," Kane said, "and we were so stunned for such a long time that it wasn't the time for those questions. Now is the time." In Massachusetts, more than 600 gay and lesbian couples applied for marriage licenses on Monday, the day Massachusetts became the first state in the union to allow same-sex marriages. Meanwhile, in Washington, President Bush issued a statement saying, quote, "The sacred institution of marriage should not be redefined by a few activist judges."
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be. No, no. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east too far. Whoa, mercy, mercy me. Oh, mercy. All things ain't what they used to be. No, so far. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury. Underground in the
Mercy, Mercy Me. Marvin Gaye here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting on over 200 public radio and television stations around the country, Pacifica stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, our first PBS station, as well as at democracynow.org video and audio streaming across Canada and also broadcasting on radio stations across Australia. This is the largest public media collaboration in the United States. In Miami, a trial has just begun involving the Justice Department and Greenpeace that could have a wide-reaching impact on the future of protest in this country. Justice Department is using an obscure 1872 law that forbids sailor mongering to prosecute Greenpeace for the actions of two of its members. In April 2002, two Greenpeace activists boarded a ship that was believed to be illegally carrying mahogany from Brazil. They hoisted a banner saying, "President Bush, stop illegal logging." The activists were both arrested. They soon pled guilty to misdemeanors. Their sentence was time served. The case turned out to be just the beginning. 15 months later, John Ashcroft's Justice Department filed criminal charges against Greenpeace. We're joined now by Greenpeace Executive Director John Passacantando. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. You're going to the Miami courthouse. Tell us briefly what this case is all about.
Well, what's happening is for the first time in our 230 years of history and in Greenpeace's 33 years of history, the federal government is trying to criminalize a peaceful organization, Greenpeace, for fostering the activities of dissent, the free speech activities of its activists. So while Greenpeace was absolutely behind what these activists did in boarding this ship that contained illegally logged mahogany from the Amazon against Brazilian law, and against U.S. law, that wood was not supposed to be cut, and it's not supposed to be imported into the country because it's an endangered species. And in fact, we have pled not guilty. We did not actually break that law. They're talking about the sailor mongering. But even that aside, the first time in U.S. history that the government wants to criminalize the group behind the activists, it's as if the government would have criminalized the NAACP, the SCLC, any of the 60s civil rights groups. The government has never done that. It has always punished the activists for the free speech activities, but never the organization behind them. It just shows the level, in my mind, that this administration will go to silence its critics.
We're talking to John Passacantando. He is Greenpeace Executive Director in Miami. How did this happen? I mean, even the charges were brought 15 months after the so-called crime was committed.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it is the most bizarre thing that has ever happened to us in our history. What we did in Miami, where these activists went out and met this boat 3 to 6 miles off the coast of Miami, highlighted, put a spotlight on the fact that illegally logged mahogany, destroying the Amazon, was coming into this country. We were doing activities like this all around the world and achieved a very successful moratorium that President Bush, as window dressing, actually supported, a moratorium against the cutting of these trees. But then behind the scenes, the federal government convened a grand jury, was subpoenaing and questioning my activists. And then almost 2 years later, we had the first federal indictment of a peaceful, nonviolent organization in U.S. history. It really is, the world has changed in this Bush era, but the judge has granted our right to have a jury trial. A jury was selected yesterday, and I have to tell you that while it is, a very strange experience for us to be fighting for our right to dissent and the right of any Americans to dissent, I think we can prevail in this.
What does this mean at this point, the timing of this? I mean, whether or not the Justice Department thought they would win, we're moving into perhaps a time of the most intense protest in a long time as we move into the Republican and Democratic conventions in this election year. What effect has it had on Greenpeace and also on other groups?
Well, it's certainly getting a good deal of publicity. I think there probably are groups that are looking at this and thinking, can we dissent anymore? And to what degree can we do that? They're seeing this. This is clearly an attempt to have this chilling effect. on Greenpeace and to make an example of Greenpeace. I think if we hold our ground and remain dignified and do our work in the peaceful and clear manner that we always have, I think we can prevail and create an example to show that even the Bush administration, even Attorney General John Ashcroft, with all their power, can't suppress dissent in the United States, because people know, even if they don't do it themselves, that they benefit from the people who peacefully dissent to keep our democracy healthy. I think we can prevail in this, but there's a jury that's going to determine that over the next week and a half.
So what is the process of this trial? What's happened so far?
Well, a jury was selected yesterday, and I'm rushing off to opening statements by the government this morning and by my lawyers. And then we'll go back and forth through witnesses, and each side will present its case. And then the judge will give instructions to the jury, and we'll see where we stand in a few days.
And is John Ashcroft personally involved?
No, his prosecutors from the South Miami office are in the courtroom, and they're representing the United States government.
Has this stopped Greenpeace from focusing on the issues of the environment that you usually focus on as you prepare for this trial?
Well, I have to say it's not stopped us. There's planning going on. There's major activities coming, even back in U.S. forests. As they are being put to the blade by many contributors, campaign contributors to George Bush. But what I must admit is that this is costing us an enormous amount of money and time, and we have a lot of our leadership down here tied up in this lawsuit. And all I can say is it's our duty to prevail in this, and we're doing everything we can to do so.
I want to thank you very much, John Passacontando, for joining us, head of Greenpeace, now in Miami for the court case. This is Democracy Now! As we move on to the Middle East, at least 12 Palestinians have died overnight. What may be the largest offensive in Gaza since the 67 war? Thousands of Palestinians fled Rafah Monday before Israel sealed off the city, cutting it off from the rest of Gaza. Civilians bundled away belongings on donkey carts, fearing their houses would be destroyed. Many slept in the streets. Last week, Israel demolished over 100 homes, leaving 1,000 Palestinians homeless. The armies threatened to demolish hundreds of more homes. Amnesty International has called on Israel to immediately stop the home demolitions, and two members of Israel's parliament have denounced the destruction as a war crime. Since the beginning of the Intifada more than 3 years ago, Israel's armored bulldozers have destroyed 1,200 houses in Rafah, and according to the UN, made more than 12,000 people homeless, one in 10 of the population. Israeli gunships bombed targets in the city of 90,000 overnight, including the Tel Sultan Mosque. Israel claims the attack in Rafah is justified and needed to secure the Gaza-Egyptian border, where they say weapons are being smuggled through the underground tunnels. Last week, five Israeli soldiers died in Rafah, a day after six were killed in Gaza City. We turn first to Uri Avneri, who is an Israeli writer and peace activist with the group Gush Shalom, former member of Knesset, and was a member of the right-wing Irgun underground in the 1940s before Israeli independence. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hello. Yes, good day.
It's good to have you with us. Can you share your reaction to what's happening right now in Rafah?
Well, I think it's a terrible situation. It's an operation which is completely unjustified. It is more in the nature of a revenge for the guerrilla attack in which five Israeli soldiers died. I think it's a kind of punishment, of collective punishment. I don't see the military justification for such an action when Mr. Sharon himself has declared that we don't need the Gaza Strip and should get out, and when the Minister of Defense and former Chief of Staff, Mr. Mofaz, says that the Gaza Strip has no military value for Israel and should be abandoned. In spite of all these declarations, now the army has practically declared a war on this town, Rafiah or Rafah, and people are dying, and people are, and soldiers are in fighting, and are, their life is being jeopardized for what?
Uri Avnery, this weekend, 150,000 Israelis rallied in Rabin Square in Tel Aviv, calling for Israel to pull out of Gaza, the largest peace protest since the 1980s during the invasion of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. Can you talk about these overwhelming polls that show Israelis favor pulling settlements out of Gaza?
Well, the vast majority of Israelis is against the settlements in general, and especially against the settlements in the Gaza Strip, because there 7,500 settlers are living in the middle of 1.25 million Palestinians who hate them. They take away their land, they take away their water, and no one sees any justification for their being there. So when Sharon proposed, or maybe pretended to propose, to evacuate the Gaza Strip and take out the settlements, this enjoyed overwhelming public support. Unfortunately, it is very questionable if Sharon actually meant to do it, because he said that he's going to do it next year. If he really wanted to do it, he should have done it within days. But his own party has voted against it. So now we are left with Sharon without a plan, with fighting in the Gaza Strip, with people dying on both sides in the Gaza Strip, and no one knows exactly what for.
Uri Avnery, we also are joined on the line from Gaza by Dr. Haider al-Dashafi. He is a veteran Palestinian politician, has led several Palestinian delegations to peace talks, most prominently the 91 Madrid conference and subsequent Washington talks, also a physician and head of the Red Crescent in the Gaza Strip. Can you describe what is happening now in Gaza? Dr. Haider al-Dashafi.
Yes. Hi, everybody. Actually, it's what's going on, not only today, but since the beginning, it's frank aggression against the Palestinian people. I think in spite of the declared position of the Palestinian, which is very modest and very conciliatory, I don't see any reason for all this protracted suffering and aggression on the Palestinian people. Of course, I know very well the historical aspect that in the first Zionist conference, Zionism claimed all of Palestine except the Gaza Strip. It was specified initially that Zionism is not interested in the Gaza Strip. But anyhow, in the context of the conflict, the Israelis settled in Gaza. And according to the original claims, as I say, Zionism was not interested in Gaza. And they want to withdraw. I understand this because it did not come up in the first Zionist Congress. They don't claim Gaza. But I see now that, and Sharon, of course, he acts on this principle. But now some of the settlers, they like Gaza, they don't want to leave it. And I assume that the Israeli government ought to make it, to take out of this issue a bargaining position with respect to the final settlement. And really, I don't see any reason why this should be so. Our declared position is very conciliatory when we are asking for a Palestinian state. In less than 1/4 of Palestine, I don't know what more concessions Israel wants from us. And of course, I mean, I know that Israel, since right after the occupation in 1967, it started its settlement activity so that it would not be committed to our declared conciliatory position. This is all that is going on.
We are talking to Dr. Haider Abdelshafi. He is a Palestinian physician, head of the Red Crescent in Gaza Strip, speaking to him in Gaza, also a political leader from Gaza. And we're speaking with Uri Avneri, who is an Israeli writer and peace activist with the group Gush Shalom. This is Democracy Now!, back in a minute. Khalid singing John Lennon's Imagine in Hebrew and Arabic. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our discussion on what is happening right now in Gaza. We're speaking with Dr. Haider Abdelshafi, who is a veteran Palestinian politician and physician, head of the Red Crescent in Gaza Strip, Uri Avneri, Israeli peace activist with the group Gush Shalom, and we've also been joined by Dr. Manal Awad, head of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, a nonprofit that provides community health, mental health services in the Gaza Strip. Dr. Manal Awad, can you talk about the pressure that Gazans are under right now?
Hello, everybody. I'm here, I'm talking from Gaza. Unfortunately, I can't really be with my family who are living now in Rafah. But I'm trying to contact them from now to now by telephone to hear about the news, to call. Also, other friends are available in Tal Sultan area, which was under curfew since this morning. And until now, we have 17 Palestinians who was killed. And I don't know exactly what is the main reason to do this. But I will tell you something. I'm a woman, and I'm working as a director for Women's Empowerment Project as a part of Gaza Community Mental Health Program. And with this situation, we tried, you know, just to find, you know, any way to reach the people who are available there to give them any kind of help. But unfortunately, during this very bad circumstances, it's not easy for anyone. Also, for the ambulances, for the Red Cross to reach the people. But what I can do, that until now, that we put our counseling telephone line on the TV, on the radio stations, the Palestinian radio stations, that to be easy for anyone, for of the Palestinians who really want to or have any psychological or we can say a trauma because this shelling, shooting, killing, I don't know exactly about this crime that we are having there in Rafah, just to try to reach us, if it is also possible, because the people there without electricity and also without water. So really, we are trying, you know, but it's not easy. Rafah is, since yesterday, now isolated from the other parts of Gaza Strip, and it was not easy for anyone to try to enter. And this is not new, because I'm citizen from Rafah, and I'm living there, and since this intifada started, this is story of continuous destroying of the houses. You know, it's continuous, and it is started with small groups of families, and now they are working in very large scale. And really, I want to ask, what is the justification to do this? All the time we heard about, you know, they try to destroy the tunnels on the borders. But really, also, if there is tunnels available, it means that you have to kill hundreds or thousands of Palestinians, you know, just to say or to say that you are trying to find, you know, the security for you and for your people there. I'm talking about Sharon. So the situation there, that is, it's a kind of catastrophe that's really, we can't do anything about it.
We're talking to Dr. Manal Awad, joining us from the Gaza Strip. Her family in Rafah, unable to get there for the last few weeks. Uri Avneri, Amnesty International has called the destruction of thousands of Palestinians' homes a war crime. Your response as an Israeli peace activist?
Well, I think it is a war crime. And it's completely unjustified, because the official reason is that the Israeli army is keeping a very narrow strip, a strip of about 100, 200 yards wide, but 7 kilometers, 5 miles long, between the Gaza Strip and the Egyptian territory, in order to cut off the Gaza Strip from the world. I think if we are going to leave the Gaza Strip, we should leave this strip too, because we don't need it. It's not our business to cut off the Gaza Strip from Egypt. It doesn't make sense in the long run. And if we want peace, we should get out of there.
Uri Avneri, we've just been joined by Amira Haas, who is the correspondent from the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, one of Israel's leading journalists. Just came out of Rafah. Welcome to Democracy Now, Amira.
Good afternoon. I didn't come. I'm in Rafah now.
You are in Rafah. Can you describe what's happening there?
The army has actually occupied one major neighborhood of Rafah. It's all of refugees, about 25,000 people in the north of Rafah, not far from Israeli settlements. And it has, in the meanwhile, it has killed there 14 people. Most of them are civilians. A few are were armed people. But a few. It also killed some armed people earlier this morning in another neighborhood of Rafah, which was not occupied, which was not taken over by the army. The city is all disconnected from the rest of the world and the rest of the Gaza Strip. There is even difficulty to move to transfer the severely wounded people to other hospitals which have better services than the hospital in Rafah, but there is not even enough place in the morgue of the hospital in Rafah for all the dead people. Ambulances in Rafah, in Tel Sultan, were not allowed to move around and to take some of the killed and the wounded. I know that there are two children also who were killed in Tel el-Sultan. They went up on the roof to give food for their doves, pigeons, and they were killed there. The army is soldiers are going up on the roofs of the neighborhood and put their sharpshooters who control the area. And Rafah is empty. The schools were not, students did not go to school today, of course. Everything is on an emergency situation. Streets are empty. There is all the time shooting, mostly by the army. There is little, I think, very little resistance to the army inside Tel el-Sultan. Everybody was taken by surprise because people expected that the army would enter into the border, neighborhoods which are at the border with Egypt, and the neighborhoods where many of the people have left during the last 3-4 days, fearing that the army is going to demolish their houses. And the army says they are going after wanted people and people who are merchants who are supposed to be passing to smuggling goods and arms from Egypt to the Gaza Strip.
Amira Haas, can you describe how this situation now compares to what you've been covering? You've been living in the occupied territories, very unusual for a Jewish journalist, for an Israeli journalist, for years now. How does this compare, what you're seeing in Rafah?
Rafah, since the beginning of the Intifada, has been the worst place, worse than Jenin, 2 years ago. Already before that, the number of houses, the economical deterioration, physical and emotional deterioration, sense of no hope and that nobody cares is the strongest in Rafah of all other places that I know in the West Bank and Gaza. And still I must say that during the last 320, until today, today are 18, but until today 320 people in Rafah were killed out of 160,000 people. It's as if in Israel, which has 6 million people, 12,000 people would have been killed in a matter of 3 years and a half. So it's a terrible number. At least 200 of those who were killed are children. 27 are women. So we're talking about the great majority of those who were killed were civilians. And I must say that during the last, I mean, what the scenes that I've been seeing the last 2-3 days of people just dismantling their homes, taking everything which is possible, starting from their rice bags and ending with their windows and the wood of the windows and the doors, and taking them out to other places in Rafah, not finding any place actually to live in now. This was the worst sight that I've experienced during the last 3 years and a half. Hundreds of people just using every possible means to move the things from their house, which they fear will be destroyed, demolished by the Israeli army, for any pretext that it might have, and going with it to unknown places. I've been seeing people that are storing now their furniture and poor, very poor furniture and mattresses on the sand near some other houses. I've seen people going to their neighbors and relatives and stuffing everything inside. There is no new rooms to rent in Rafah. It's all filled. By the way, now the army is occupying and probably, I don't know what they are doing yet, or doing now, but in a neighborhood which was built in some blocks which the UNRWA built during the last half year or so for people who had lost their houses at the beginning of the Intifada. So I must say that this was really the worst that I've been seeing. I mean, the most, fatalist and you see the total lack of hope of anyone. It's something that I haven't seen before. And in spite of the pride that they had, that they are fighting against this huge Israeli, strong Israeli army. But people are completely at a loss.
What is the Gazans, the refugees in the Rafah camp, response to you as an Israeli journalist?
Look, I've been here for, I started coming to Gaza almost 12 or 13 years ago, so I'm not, many people know me, and those who don't know me, at first, they start talking in generalities, you the Jews, and then I'm kidding about this, and then we continue, and it becomes, I mean, slowly, they treat me as a person, not as a representative of anybody, and then friends of mine, or people, or their friends, very quickly learn how not to say the Jews when they mean the army. They say the army when they mean the army. They say the Israelis, and they say the Jews. They differentiate between these three concepts because they know me.
Dr. Manal Awad, the psychological conditions now, since that's what you deal with, the issue of mental health for Gazans. Dr. Manal Awad. Well, let's see if Dr. Haider Abdel Shafi is still on the line. Are you still there?
Yes.
Yes. Right now, what you are calling for, I'm sure you have you've heard these descriptions before that Amira Haas is describing, that you are living in Gaza. What do you want now?
Well, I say again, I mean, our declared position that we accepted a state in the borders of 1967, it is, I think, it proves that we are conciliatory, we want peace, we don't want this confrontation that entails suffering on both sides. I think our position is very realistic, and I don't see why Israel comes up and makes. I know that, I mean, Israel is acting on the basis of the initial and Zionist claims that were voiced in the first Zionist conference. But it is time to realize that what was said in the first Zionist Congress is not workable. It entails the sacrifice of a whole population, Palestinians. And it's time that everybody sobers up and see the end of this a terrible conflict that's going on.
Let me ask Uri Avneri finally, what does President Bush's support for Ariel Sharon mean for you in Israel? And do you follow U.S. politics? Do you see John Kerry's position as any different?
Well, looking at it from afar, there doesn't seem to be any difference at all between Mr. Bush and Mr. Kerry. But I suppose that Mr. Kerry is saying what he is saying because he needs the votes of the Jewish people over there who support Israel. It's Mr. Bush who is partly or very much responsible for this present disaster. He has given a totally free hand to Mr. Sharon. He supports Mr. Sharon unconditionally. That Mr. Sharon believes that he can do whatever he wants to do and will enjoy the support of Mr. Bush, whatever happens. And then they are sending Condoleezza Rice and the poor Colin Powell to meet the Palestinian prime minister and give him empty words, which mean nothing at all. The thing is that Mr. Sharon wants to crush the Palestinian resistance to the occupation. Everything has to be seen in this context. The basic fact is there is an occupation, and there is a resistance to the occupation, which now in Gaza has the character of a classic guerrilla war. And the Israeli army is trying to crush to use this overwhelming force to crush this guerrilla resistance. And this is something which has never succeeded anywhere in the world. An irregular army with tanks and artillery and air force cannot crush local resistance, a local guerrilla war, which enjoys the support, the total support of the whole population.
On that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Uri Avneri of the Israeli peace activist group Gush Shalom, Amira Haas, a correspondent for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz in Rafah right now, won the UNESCO World Press Freedom Prize, among many others, and Dr. Haider Abdeshafi, veteran Palestinian politician, physician, head of the Red Crescent in Gaza Strip. This is Democracy Now!, back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The income gap in the United States is greater than many imagine. The top 29,000 Americans have as much income as the bottom 96 million. In recent years, tax burden for the richest Americans, especially corporations, has been falling sharply while everyone else's has risen. A study by the General Accounting Office found almost two-thirds of America's corporations paid no federal income taxes during the late 90s when corporate profits were soaring. 9 out of 10 companies paid less than the equivalent of 5% of their total income. A new book by Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter David K. Johnston argues that most Americans are, quote, being duped into supplementing the incomes and extravagant lifestyles of the rich and powerful. The book is titled Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. Last month, Johnston was awarded top honors at the 2003 Investigative Reporters and Editors Awards for Perfectly Legal. I began by asking David K. Johnston about just how the tax system works.
Most Americans, no matter what they make, assume that people who make more pay a larger share of their income in federal taxes. That would be a progressive tax system. We don't have that. If you made $60,000 last year, you paid a larger share of your income in income taxes and Social Security taxes to the government than people who made more than $10 million a year. And that top group's average income, by the way, was $25.6 million. If you made $400,000, and that's a lot of money, but if you made $400,000, you paid a larger share of your income just in income taxes than people who made more than $10 million. That is, people who made in a week what you worked for all year. And we are shifting the burden of taxes steadily off the richest people in America and onto people who work. The very top taxpayers, the 400 highest income taxpayers in America, their taxes have gone from 30 cents on the dollar, which doesn't strike me as an onerous burden, 30 cents on the dollar back in 1993 when the Clinton administration began, down to 22 cents on the dollar at the end of the Clinton administration, and now under the Bush administration, they're down to 17.5 cents on the dollar. Everybody else in America during those years, their taxes went up from 13 cents on the dollar overall to 15.
Who's doing this?
Both parties are doing this. They're doing it because they're listening to a narrow group of very well-to-do people who do not want to pay taxes, who do not want to share in the expenses of the country that has made them rich, and they want you to pay their taxes. Those are the people who get access. Every politician will say to you, you can't buy my vote. And generally, that's true. The problem is that you and I don't have real access. And the proof that Congress is thinking about the super rich came 2 days after 9/11. The House Republican leadership introduced 10 bills to address 9/11, and one of them was a tax bill. And so what did it do? It gave estate tax relief, which did absolutely nothing for the firefighters and the police officers and the Army sergeants at their desk and the nurses and the busboy at the World Trade Center and all those other people who were killed. A tiny handful of people. But that's what Congress thought these people needed, was estate tax relief, even though 99% of them wouldn't pay estate taxes.
So it's just slipping it in at a very opportune time.
Well, that was just for this group of people. That was just for this group of people, but it's indicative of what Congress is thinking about. What's on the minds of Congress are not the concerns of ordinary Americans who want to educate their children, you know, who want to engage in enjoying life. Their concerns are about the super rich, and within the super rich, those who are very anti-tax.
Can you talk about the CEO of Coca-Cola?
Oh, sure. He's indicative of a major problem that many workers don't understand is affecting them. Roberto Gazzetta, during the years that he ran Coca-Cola, built a $1 billion untaxed fortune. And the way that he did that is having a serious effect on ordinary workers. All across America, senior executives have unlimited 401k plans. There's a special law for them. Ordinary Americans are allowed to save up to $13,000, or if you're my age, $16,000. But let's say you're the CEO of a big company and you get paid $105 million, and this is already an outrageous amount of money. You take $5 million of it in cash, you pay the taxes on it. That's about $1.7 million. So your effective tax rate is less than 2% of your income. The other $100 million stays on deposit with the company. The company invests it on your behalf, and you take the money when you're ready to retire. The problem is the company doesn't get to take a deduction for that $100 million. So it has to pay the government $35 million in taxes. Well, every year, senior executives add to these accounts, and there are lots of them, not just the CEO. Pretty soon the company comes to the workers and says, you know, Amy, we know you've had this health care plan, but we just can't afford it anymore. It's too expensive. Or that pension plan you were counting on, well, we're going to freeze it when you're 52 years old, so you're only going to get a third of the benefit you were expecting at retirement because we can't afford it. Competitive pressure. It's the competitive pressure from the guys in the executive suite going into the pay pool and gouging it. It's not from the people down the street. And Congress could stop this in a minute. And furthermore, raise revenue by saying there's no more deferrals.
Can you talk about Dick Cheney and his deferred payment plan from Halliburton, the fact that this man is the sitting vice president of the United States and continues to be paid off by...
No, he cashed out of his plan except for his pension, which would not make him in a position any different than anyone else.
But he is getting an annual paycheck from Halliburton still to this day.
Or he will when he turns 65. I'm not sure if he's 65 years old yet. Actually, that doesn't trouble me. He's cut all his other ties to the company. What should trouble people is here's a guy who, in a very short period of running this company, built up a $36 million cash-out plan when he left and set up, I forget exactly how many, but many, many offshore vehicles that were designed basically to avoid taxes. Almost every big corporation in America now is using a variety of devices, from renting a mailbox in Bermuda to moving their intellectual property offshore to avoid taxes. And we just had a report from the investigative arm of Congress, the General Accounting Office, that 60% of American corporations paid no corporate income tax between 1996 and 1970.
Say that again.
60% of large corporations paid no federal corporate income tax from 1996 to 2000, that five-year period.
How does that work? What do you mean they just get a foreign post office box?
Well, 2 years ago, I broke the story in the New York Times about companies going to Bermuda. Ingersoll Rand, for example, went to Bermuda. They're the people who built the jackhammer that carved the face of Mount Rushmore. They didn't go to Bermuda. Their headquarters is still in New Jersey. The Bermuda government, in return for a fee of $27,000, allows them to be a Bermuda company prohibited from doing business in Bermuda. They then send one executive to Barbados, and under a treaty that dates to the Cold War, the company is then able to take its profits in the U.S. and convert them into tax-deductible expenses, send them to Barbados, and put the money wherever they want in the world and stop paying U.S. income taxes on their profits. And in the process, they shift the burden of government off of them and onto you. So they get all the benefits of being here, the courts to enforce their contracts and access to the American market, the military to protect their assets, but you and I get the bill.
Enron.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about Enron and taxes?
Well, Enron was an extreme example of taxes. Their tax department was turned into a profit center. And the people in the tax department were expected to turn up profits. Here's a little known fact for you. Enron, although people think of it as a Texas company, it is actually an Oregon public utility holding company. And it bought Portland General Electric. And since 1997, the people and businesses in Portland have paid about $620 million in their electric rates that were supposed to pay the state and federal income taxes of Portland General Electric. But Portland General Electric just shipped the money upstairs to Enron. Enron paid no taxes. Imagine how rich you could get if you could buy a business which the law says you will collect the income taxes for the corporation from your customers as a specific amount of money, and then you get to pocket it. That's what Enron did.
We're talking to David K. Johnston. Perfectly Legal is his new book, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. As you researched this book, what most surprised you?
Oh, that the middle class and the upper middle class literally subsidize the wealthiest people in America. If you're making $50,000 a year, the federal government will take about $2,000 from you this year, or as President Bush would say, $2,000 of your money, and funnel it to the super rich through overtaxing you on Social Security. Americans are paying in advance for their Social Security benefits up to the limit on Social Security incomes. That money is being used to finance tax cuts for the super rich, who in 10 or 15 or 20 years will have to pay higher taxes to get that money back. So the time value of about $1.8 trillion is being transferred from the middle class to the super rich. The other thing that astonished me is the stealthy way that the Bush tax cuts were financed. The Bush tax cuts include a $500 billion increase on middle class and upper middle class Americans, particularly families with children. You're 30 times more likely to pay this stealth tax increase if you have children than if you're single, which totally is against the rhetoric that you're hearing from the administration. And under the law that the administration relied on, if you become ill or your spouse or child does, and you spend more than 7.5% of your income trying to keep your loved one or yourself alive, Congress taxes you for doing that. It increases your income taxes, and it uses that money to finance tax cuts for the super rich. That's just outrageous.
David K. Johnston, author of Perfectly Legal, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Or you can order it through our website at democracynow.org, as well as sign up for our daily digest, news headlines, and media alerts, as well as go to our website for the latest information and contact information. Exception to the Rulers Media and Book Tour continues on Wednesday night in Pleasantville, New York at the Jacob Burns Center, beginning at 5:30, showing the film The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, followed by Independent Media in a Time of War, produced by the Hudson Mohawk Indie Media Center, and I'll be speaking there as well, Jacob Burns Center, Pleasantville, New York. That does it for the show, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Shroof Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.